Eat Drink Indiana Radio is powered by EatDrinkIndy.com. Eat local, drink local, eat drink Indy. Welcome to Eat Drink Indiana Radio on WFYI HD to the Point. I'm your host, Jolene Katzenberger. This week on Eat Drink Indiana Radio, we are talking about what happens when you decide to do it yourself. When you see a need for something and teach yourself how to make it, or when a hobby grows into a business and you find yourself on a totally different path than the one you started on. There are lots of career-changing food entrepreneurs out there in Central Indiana, and I've rounded up interviews that we've done here on Eat Drink Indiana Radio over the past few months with inspiring folks who have taken on a challenge and taught themselves a new skill, from making bread or bacon to making coffee or even knives. We'll hear from Haley McGinley of Native Bread, Mark LaFay of Old Major Market, Eric Gieseman and Eric Smith of Ash Blades, and Andy and Sarah Hessler of Blue Mine Roasting. So stay with us for more here on Eat Drink Indiana Radio on WFYI and WFYI.org. Indianapolis and Central Indiana has so much happening on the local food scene with chefs and restaurants and farmers and food artisans, and we talk to all of them here on Eat Drink Indiana Radio. But I wanted to focus this week's show on a few entrepreneurs that I have found particularly inspiring, regular people who just decided to do it themselves. Now, this is a pretty appealing notion. We've talked with businesses and accidental entrepreneurs who have found themselves making everything from beer to peanut butter to tamales. But this week, we're looking back at a few recent entrepreneurial interviews, starting with Haley McGinley, who just wanted a good hearty loaf of locally made gluten-free bread. And when she couldn't find it, she decided to learn how to do it herself. And this past summer, she launched Native Bread. I stopped in at the downtown commercial kitchen when she was busy baking recently to talk about how she took her bread business from idea to reality.
I'm still very new to this game, and the thing that I'm finding is for me, it's one day at a time, one step at a time. If I think about everything that needs to be accomplished all at once, it's very overwhelming. And Hannah's been great with, you know, helping me and supporting me with all of that too.
Now that's Hannah Lindgren, who just recently did the Food First documentary.
Yes, yes. She's our marketing director. She's phenomenal. And so grateful to have her helping me through all of this.
When you first had the idea, how did you take it from a passing idea into a real business where we're in a commercial kitchen, you're selling to restaurants? So how does that happen?
Oh, God. I don't even know. It's like my dreams are just answered every day. I think I'm a big believer in the law of attraction. And I put it out there. I had this vision and this idea, and I told it to my friends and I told it to my family, and everybody was super supportive. And I just was like, okay, well, what's step one? What do I have to do first? So the first thing is I need to start baking, right? So I go to my favorite grocery store, Good Earth and Broad Ripple, and I start, you know, I buy the ingredients, and then I start testing recipes and letting my friends taste test. And so just starting really small and focusing on what can I do right now? What needs to happen right now? And then just moving from there. And then Hannah connected me with Chris Baggett, and then he graciously offered to let me sort of, you know, practice what it would be like to produce on a larger scale in his kitchen at Cluster Truck.
That's right. So he has Cluster Truck, and it's part of FarmersMarket.com, and has become very active in the local food community. So that was another good connection.
Mm-hmm. Yes, absolutely. A great connection. And another resource that I used a lot, and I'm still seeing them, is SCORE. And they're a free resource for anybody, whether you're, you know, a brand new starting up a business or you're CEO, you know, of a huge corporation. They help you, they support you and give you resources and things like that
This is the organization of retired executives who provide mentorship and counseling, right?
Yes, exactly. And they're great. They're so great. They're so passionate about what they do. You can just tell they love it. So I've been meeting with people at SCORE for, gosh, a few months now. So they were kind of the initial, my initial mentors in the game, and other than Hannah.
Now tell me what the time frame was. When did you said you started this? Started thinking about it at the winter market. So how long has it taken?
Not that long. That's the other crazy thing, is the response has been so positive, so quick. Yeah, I had the thought, and I'm really bad with time. It was in the winter when I had the vision and the thought, and then I just started testing recipes at home, and then...
So you were baking last winter, right? This past winter. Mm-hmm. Where did it go from there?
Right. I think the next step was letting my friends taste it, and then we met up with Chris and brought him bread to sample. And then we slowly started putting things out on social media. And once I felt like I had perfected the recipes I wanted to sort of launch with. Because I could just keep tweaking the recipes and keep tweaking them and doing that over and over until it's absolutely perfect. And then Hannah was like, Haley, you just got to put it out there. This is such good bread. People are going to love it. You just have to... do it. Put it out there.
Was that hard? Was that hard to sort of let go of the planning in the getting ready phase?
Yeah, it was. It was and it wasn't. There was a side of me that was super excited to get it out there and like, okay, let's just do this and make it happen. And there's another part of me that was like, oh my God, okay, once I put it out there, this is real. Like, it's happening. And now people are going to, have certain expectations, and I have to produce bread, and there was both sides of that with me for sure.
So when did you launch it? When did you put it out there like that?
Recently, very recently. What is this? Almost, gosh, we're in August. We had a photo shoot. So the thing that we were waiting to do, we had a photo shoot at my house. It was a picnic themed photo shoot. Hannah did the photography for it, and with those photos, she crafted the website, and that was sort of when we officially launched. We had already done like little things here and there on Instagram mainly, but now we're loud and proud on Facebook, and we do Snapchat, and our website's up and running. So that was all within the past month, I believe. I mean, it's been very recent.
So we're kind of moving toward the end of August, and so it's been within this past month?
Yeah, and I'm friends with Jordan, the manager at the Garden Table, and she knew about Native Bread and was, saying, okay, when are you going to bring us bread? We want to sample it. And so I took them a loaf to sample just a few weeks ago, and maybe 2 weeks ago, and they loved it. They were like, this is phenomenal. We want to sell it. Yes, 100%. Yes, we want to have your bread here. And so they're my first restaurant account.
Well, that must be so gratifying to get that kind of response.
It's exciting. Yeah. I hope other restaurants want to get on board too.
Was it a little, a little scary to be out there all of a sudden?
I don't know if scary is the right word. It's just kind of cool. I'm like, this is really neat. I'm really just excited that I'm creating something that other people like. And when I had this vision, I really just wanted to make good quality bread, and I'm doing that, and everyone loves it. So it's so awesome.
Now, what's the next steps? Where do you go from here? I mean, you're working in a little corner of a commercial kitchen. So what happens when you expand? Because this is probably going to go places, right?
Yeah. Yes. That's definitely my vision and my hope. And so we're currently seeking out a commercial kitchen that we would be able to have access to whenever we would need it, and also store our ingredients there. So right now I'm prepping everything at my house and then bringing it here to bake it. So there's a lot of prep work involved and time in that. And but yeah, going forward, just once we find a commercial kitchen space that we can have access to whenever we need it, then that's when we'll really be able to take off and grow. And so for right now, we're just limited on the amount of bread that we can make. And right now it's just me doing it too. And I really couldn't have anyone else because it's such a small space. So
so tell me what products you have now and where you see the product line going.
So right now we have a seeded whole grain boule, a honey oat loaf, and a sourdough loaf. And each loaf is hand formed by me. And so going, you know, moving forward, I love, like I said, I have a sweet tooth, so I definitely want to do a cinnamon raisin loaf, cinnamon buns, scones, pretzels. I've thought about doing English muffins and bagels and pizza dough. I want to make an awesome pizza crust, so when I go to restaurants and, you know, pizzerias, I can order pizza and, again, feel good about it and not have to worry about waking up the next day with achy joints and a swollen face because of the inflammation from gluten. So
you have come at this from a health perspective, but I'm sure that you also are paying a lot of attention to the taste and the satisfaction, so it's not just healthy.
I'm definitely coming at it from a healthy that's my primary focus. And as far as, I mean, they really are nutrient-dense breads.
Now tell me a little bit about the ingredients that you're using and the ones you're trying to avoid, you know, to boost that nutritional value.
Sure. I use all whole grains. I don't use any white rice flour. I don't use cornstarch, so all the breads are corn-free as well. So I use the maximum amount of whole grains as I can, and the minimum amount of starches to still create a product that resembles and feels and tastes like bread. And the main grains I'm using are sorghum, brown rice flour, millet, teff, oat flour. The seeded whole grain boule, I use sunflower seeds, flax seeds, sesame seeds, and poppy seeds. And I'm sourcing ingredients locally, so the honey oat loaf, using local honey for that. We're still communicating with a couple different places to see which one we want to go with. So I don't want to say right now, but I think we know who we're going to go with. So local honey, and also getting organic ingredients whenever they're available. So sometimes things, you just can't get them organically, unfortunately, but whenever an organic option is there, then that's what we use.
And, you know, so you mentioned the sweet things, so you see yourself expanding in that way in the future as well?
Mm-hmm. Yes, and also with savory, I've worked on a baguette in the past, but haven't been successful yet, so I'm still working on a baguette recipe. And then seasonal things for the holidays, doing like fun little pumpkin things for Christmas and Thanksgiving. And I love the holidays, so I definitely want to have something, you know, related, like a holiday-themed bread. And I also want to say, too, while I'm thinking of it on the healthy point of the breads, I don't use any sugar either. So there's no processed sugar. I don't even use cane sugar. And maybe moving forward, when I do like a cinnamon bun, I'm looking at just using coconut sugar. So that's much, has a lower glycemic, you know, it doesn't affect your glycemic level as much as like cane sugar would. So being conscious of that as well.
Has it been challenging trying to do that, to, you know, use those sorts of nutrient-dense ingredients and still get a tasty, satisfying loaf of bread?
Actually, no. I don't think so. And so far, the response hasn't shown that either. I think the whole grains, they're very flavorful. And when you combine them, you know, there's each of my breads, there's a blend of different grains, so it's not all just one. And you can't do that with gluten-free baking anyways. You have to blend things together. And so, you know, and then I use sea salt and just a little bit of sea salt, and that just makes the flavor pop. And I just love gluten-free grains because they all have a different flavor profile, and combining them together just makes such excellent bread.
We've been talking with Haley McGinley of Native Bread. For more information and to find Haley's gluten-free artisan breads, go to nativebread.com or look for it on Facebook. We are back here on Eat Drink Indiana Radio with an entrepreneurial sort of show today. We're revisiting some recent interviews with some local food artisans who have launched a variety of businesses. Up next is bacon, which is how Mark LaFay of Old Major Market has begun his artisan meat business. Mark is something of an urban homesteader who got into gardening and preserving and smoking his own meats right in the middle of the city. And now he sells his bacon and sausages online and is looking to grow into a brick-and-mortar location in his Meridian Kessler neighborhood. Mark tells us how a barbecue hobby grew into Old Major Market.
I got interested in slow food. And when I say slow food, I don't mean the slow food movement, but I mean food that takes a long time to make, like barbecue. I want to say probably about 8 years ago. And, you know, that passion grew from, you know, making brisket or corned beef or things like that, to, you know, in the oven to, you know, starting to smoke. And so I got a, you know, electric smoker and doing that and just really enjoyed that. And then, you know, one summer I used to work in music, and one summer I had quite a bit of downtime as all my clients were on tour and all that, that I thought, well, I'm going to make a smoker. And so I went over to a buddy's house and, you know, we got on it. So we took a couple of oil tanks from somebody's, from a friend's basement, and started building a smoker, which it took us 2 years to finish both sides of it. But, and his wife was really irritated because this, it was in their backyard for about a year and a half in the process. But yeah, so, you know, and then it just, it kind of took off from there.
So that led to barbecue, maybe?
Oh yeah, totally. Yeah. So, you know, so starting to do more barbecue in the electric smoker, and then, you know, I've never been the type of person to do something kind of small. And so I thought, well, the next logical step from having a small refrigerator sized dorm refrigerator sized smoker would be to have a trailer smoker. Cause that makes sense. Right. So,
the kind you see at competitions and things like that.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. So yeah, so then it was kind of funny. My church asked me to do barbecue 1 year. And so we said, okay. And so, you know, my first big foray into, you know, large barbecue was, I think it was like 24 or 25 pork butts at once overnight in the church parking lot. So,
yeah, but that leads to more. I just know it does.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Yeah, absolutely. So yeah, so we've done like three or four more church barbecue since then and all that. But, you know, I've always been interested in, you know, in food anyways. And so this was sort of neat to be able to jump into it again.
So now what's your background? Tech, marketing, that kind of thing?
Yeah, totally. So I've got a diverse background. So, you know, I went to IUPUI and got a degree in computer technology through Purdue. But I started a music company in 1999-2000 with a good friend of mine. So we started doing concert promotion, and we were doing, I would say, the majority of all the all-ages small club concert promotion for about 10 years. And then from that, I birthed an artist management company. Did that for, you know, all of the first decade of this millennium, if you will. And, yeah, so, you know, I really learned a lot about business, a lot about marketing, a lot about brand development, identifying niche audiences and, you know, servicing. I mean, just all kinds of crazy stuff that you really couldn't, you know, learn in a textbook, and a lot of trial and error. Had some great successes, had some, you know, horrible failures, sadly, but, you know, it was a lot of fun in the meantime. And then from that, you know, when I got out of that business, you know, decided I wanted to do something that didn't require me to drink lots of beer at night and, you know, be all over the place. Cause I, you know, honestly, I wanted to settle down, have family and all that, So decided to wind that business down, and just started trying to figure out what was next.
Now, how do you figure that out? You know, how do you come up with where you're going to turn to next?
You know, I'm driven largely by faith. And so, I felt like there was a divine calling to get out of music and look for what was next. And so when I was winding my businesses down, you know, I had no idea what was going to be next. And so over the course of the year, you know, I saw my income starting to dwindle. I saw, you know, all things were getting kind of stressful. And then it was, I want to say it was end of November, and a good friend of mine, Andy Wilson, gave me a call and said, hey, I'm starting this entertainment division of a new PR company in town. Why don't you help me, you know, in some capacity? And I was like, okay, yeah, it sounds great. So, you know, he worked some magic, and he talked, you know, the owner of the company, you know, into bringing me on, because they are very small, you know, at that stage. And so adding an employee was, you know, that was a big deal, right? And so so Vicky took a gamble, and they brought me on. I feel like I added some great value to the company, and then had an opportunity to go get back into technology. And so did that, and, you know, and then that took me into technology for a few years. And yeah, so worked at a small company downtown called Sonar Studios. And, you know, our goal was to really to just to create products and spin those off into small companies that could stand on their own or could be sold or whatever. And so I did a couple of those, had one of those products acquired by a small business in town. And then I left to focus on a product that we had been inspired by while I was there, to create a piece of technology to help kids with language related learning disabilities. So we birthed a company called Lectio, which is a mobile app that helps really, I mean, anybody in any sort of capacity, whether you have dyslexia or you're just trying to learn English. I mean, really, so you could use your phone, take a picture of a page of text, it would detect all the words, and then you could tap on a word because it would become a button, and then the phone would read it aloud to you, and then it would also give you a dictionary definition. So started to work on that, and then my business partner on that started to run with that, and I started to work on a new project called Rouse, which is a social network for people that want to discuss controversial subject matter, so namely politics. So did that for the last 2 years, and you know, we built a pretty awesome site that's out there and running right now, and, you know, just ran out of funding, really, and we're trying to find different ways to continue to drive it forward. So I think that transition after Rouse was where I started to think about, well, you know, what's next again, right? So in that position, and you know, my wife and I said, well, let's just look at all the things that you love doing, and you spend all of your time when you're not working on work stuff that you enjoy doing.
Is that where the food stuff came in?
Yeah, totally. You know, I've always been passionate about food. You know, I used to weigh 260 pounds.
No way.
Yeah. So, I mean, a lot of that was late night drinking and pizza eating, you know, while I was working in music. But, you know, and I've always been passionate about food. When I was a junior in high school, I, you know, sent off an application to the Culinary Institute of America in upstate New York, you know, but decided that I wanted to pursue the route of technology and, you know, riches and fame and glory and, you know, or whatever. So, yeah, so this was, you know, why don't we try this? So I've always been passionate about hunting. I've been hunting since I was 14. You know, I shot my first deer when I was 14. You know, we go hunting is a major event in our family.
So that kind of led to working with, you know, wild game or, you know, butchery, that kind of thing.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, my dad, you know, he's always wanted to, you know, do something in butchering. And so it's kind of funny when we'd shoot a deer, we would do as much as we could given the space and time, you know. Processing your own deer is tough because in Indiana, it could be 80 degrees or it could be 20 degrees, you know, when we're out hunting, you know, in early November. So you just don't know.
So you must have kind of gotten pretty good at it.
I mean, I've gotten fast for sure. I don't know if I'm good at, you know, all the animals are different. And, you know, with deer, it's not like I would sit there thinking like, all right, I'm going to have, you know, a French cut double, you know, double chop here, chop steak or, you know, whatever. So, you know, we would cut the loins out, cut the tenderloins out, and then, you know, trim everything out, debone the animal, and then use the rest for a sausage. But yeah, you know, I mean, the idea of growing your own food, you know, preparing for winter, I mean, even though we're developed, you know, people, a lot of times people still sort of get into those cycles where we buy more groceries in the wintertime, we plant, you know. So canning fresh vegetables and, you know, curing meats and doing all that kind of stuff, you know, I think is fun and interesting. And so this has been, it's also very culinary, right? So, you know, great foods start with great ingredients.
And you have a terrific garden out back too.
Thank you. Yeah. It's a mini farm, and always looking for ways to make it more high density.
So it seems like all of these things have led you to, the idea of a market in your neighborhood.
Yeah.
Yeah, totally. Absolutely. So, you know, so the beginning of this year was a transition point again in my life. So, you know, we're looking at this, the technology company that I've been working on diligently for the last 2 years, and looking at, you know, basically having a timeline of when it was going to run out of money. And so my wife and I just started praying through and discussing, you know, what's going to be next. And so, you know, I beekeep, you know, with my dad. I, you know, go hunting, and I love meat, and I love food, and love gardening, love all these things, love traveling more so for the experience of the food and the local culture and, you know, all that kind of stuff. And I'm also very passionate about, you know, just the quality of food, and also, you know, like when it comes to animals, how people care for them and things like that, you know, and a lot of that I think is biblical too. And so my wife were just, and I were just sort of pondering all this stuff. I'm like, well, what, so what does it look like? And what we came back at was like, let's open a neighborhood market that's got sort of this craft butcher shop feel to it.
Oh, I love that idea. I think it seems like it's a good time for it. People are aware of the concept of a neighborhood butcher shop again. You know, again. It seems like something that might have gotten away from us for a while. And now we're kind of into that sort of thing again. I mean, there are models in town, you know, Goose the Market, that sort of thing.
Yep. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there's a lot. So, you know, you've got Goose, you've got, you know, Moody's is doing a lot of cool stuff. Kincaid's has been in town for a while. You know, the Dugdales had a, you know, they have their beef legacy, right? And then you've got Archers on the south and north side. So there are some that have been around for a while and have, you know, withstood the test of time. And then there's definitely the newer ones. You know, I think what was amazing when Chris came back to town and started Goose was that there was no good place to get good meats and good cheese. I mean, we had the cheese shop up in the Keystone Mall or Fashion Mall. You know, and then they had another location. I think they may have moved or, yeah, but they were sort of floating around on the north side. And I remember going there from a very early age, and just doing laps through that store to sample the Sicilian cream cheese, you know. But, you know, there was, other than that, there was no good place, you know. If you wanted, you know, sliced meats, you're talking Boar's Head, you know, at the grocery store.
Exactly. Exactly. Right? So that was the choices.
Right. Yeah. And so when, you know, Goose Market came to town, I mean, they just, you know, they brought a whole new level, right? And awareness, really. And so I think that's awesome. And there's been sort of this renaissance movement that's been happening all over the country. I mean, we've seen it, you know, in craft breweries and all this other stuff where people are going hyper-local, even within a city. You know, there's no way that I could probably get around to all the different breweries to try all the different beers, you know?
Right.
So it's become very, very hyper-local. And so, yeah, so it's exciting to see people become aware again, to care about it. I think the sustainable food movement is interesting because, you know, you look at, you know, just even this political climate, people become very suspicious of politics, the government, regulations, all this kind of stuff. And, you know, even the organic moniker, which once was a seal of approval for a lot of people that wanted to know what they were eating was quality. You know, now you look at organic, there's like 20 or 30 different chemicals on the organic approved list. And so people see organic as not organic, but better than everything else. And so now the local moniker carries way more weight because the chances are good that if you know your butcher or you know your market owner, they know the farmer or the processor that knows the farmer. So you're 1 degree or 2 degrees of separation from the person that's raising the animal or raising the produce. And so if that person says, we don't use hormones, we don't use antibiotics, and this pig runs around and eats grass, acorns, and wood forages its entire life until it goes to slaughter, you're like, okay, that's I believe that. And that carries more weight now than the organic thing. So I think that this sustainable thing is, and the local thing is really starting to, you know, grow because of that, just that interest in clean food.
We've been talking with Mark LaFay of Old Major Market. For more information, look for it on Facebook or go to oldmajormarket.com. Tool for the job is key to any project's success. And in cooking, one key tool is a good knife. And that's the connection to our next interview today here on Eat Drink Indiana Radio. We're talking about a variety of food-related entrepreneurial enterprises today, and Ash Blades fits right in there. Friends Eric Gieseman and Eric Smith got interested in making knives, and as they got better and better at their hobby, the interest in their handmade knives began to grow. Now you can find them at local farmers markets, and chefs and home cooks alike are ordering their own custom-made knives. I talked with the guys behind Ash Blades this past spring to find out how they launched a knife-making business out of a suburban Greenfield garage.
So you are part of the food community, right?
We think we are.
Yeah?
Yeah, we absolutely think we're part of the food community. You know, we like to say that we have local tools for local food. There's a really neat groundswell, I feel like, that's happening around here between, you know, local artisans and vendors and trying to put people back in kitchens. And, you know, that's the big thing is that people aren't cooking anymore. So if we can entice people to get back into the kitchen and make food preparation enjoyable instead of a chore, that's a win for everybody.
Now, tell me again. How this came about and how you decided that you're going to learn how to make knives.
Yeah. So really it was a conversation, but a little bit before that, it was something that I'd been sharpening knives by hand for a little while. I was just really disappointed with the level of sharpness that I could get on the standard kind of just factory-bought, store-bought stuff. And as I was sharpening and I just sharpened more and more knives, I started getting a feeling about, man, I think I would just like a better knife even than what I have. You know, what does it take to make a knife? And so I did some research and then one Christmas party, we were sitting at the kitchen counter drinking a bourbon and I just said, you know, I think I want to make a knife. I don't know what you think about that. It's totally a random thing to bring up to a friend. Let's make a knife. I was like, I think I want to make a knife. And I didn't expect him. Everybody, I mean, I told some family members and they were just like, okay. I told him and he was like, let's do this. So,
yeah, kind of an interesting concept, hobby. But truthfully, I have a bit of an addictive personality. So when someone floats an idea to me, I want to get all into it. And that's what happened. Like, it became a conversation. Mm-hmm. And then it became hours every day of conversation and not getting work done at work because we were having conversations. I mean, it just became this thing where it was like, okay, I think we could actually do this. Mm-hmm. And so over the course of months, and I mean, truthfully, obviously we're still learning and we're never going to stop learning, but you know, we got to a point where we're like, this isn't half bad.
Yeah.
And so that's where this whole idea was like, well, maybe we could take these to market because we were getting really positive response. You know, people really latched onto it, but you know, it's bringing that a step back for me, you know, just working in an office environment so much, I don't feel like I could put my efforts into something at the end of the day. I can look at the final product and say, I did this. And so it's really neat to be able just to start with a bunch of random pieces of raw material and convert it into something that not only is beautiful, but is functional and it functions better than anything I've ever had in my kitchen.
How long does it take? How long did it take from when you said, yeah, I'm going to learn how to make knife to now you're making knives to order for chefs?
This is about a 3-year endeavor at this point. It was a little slow going at first because it was hobby. That's probably an important point to make. Mm-hmm. You know, we could only put an hour or so in a week really in trying to make a knife. And a knife can take 10, 15 plus hours to make. So you can imagine you don't make very many very quickly when you can only spend a couple of hours a week. But then, like Eric said, we ended up making a few that were good enough that people thought, man, maybe, you know, you could probably sell one of those. And so in earnest, we're talking about a little over a year that we've really been making a lot, just making as many knives as we can make and getting them out there for people to try. And then maybe 8 months worth of orders, probably something like that. I don't even think we've sold knives for a year.
How long did that first knife take to make, and how was that first knife? How'd it come out?
They're so ugly. They're awful. It
looked about like that.
But yeah, but we were so excited. We actually set the bevels with a file before we heat treated them, and we heat treated them in old motor oil. I made a forge out of a map torch and a paint can that I lined with ceramic wool, and we just, you know, stuck chunks of what we thought were knife-like objects in this forge and heated them up until you touch it with a magnet, and that's how you know a simple steel, a fairly simple carbon steel is at the temperature where it can be quenched, is when you touch a magnet and it won't stick. That's called the critical temperature. And so we're just poking it with magnets until it was the temperature it needed to be, and then quenched it, and then we used this old woodworking 4x36 or whatever grinder, and just hours and hours of grinding and grinding and grinding until we could cut a cardboard box, and we were so
flipped out.
Yes.
Oh my gosh. We jumped up and down and hugged each other. We did it. We've done it. Yeah, it was hilarious.
Yeah, they're terrible. I have it over there. It's the and in fact, I still use cardboard because it still does that. It's awful. The handle is giant and it's oddly shaped, and I mean the blade shape is okay, but yeah, I mean it took us probably 2 solid weekends.
Yeah.
I mean, yep. Every bit of 20 hours probably to figure it out. And we had
What was that like though when you did figure it out?
Oh, it was amazing. Really the hardest part, honestly, the absolute panic moment was the handles, because you imagine trying to align the pin material across a piece of steel that is no longer soft. You're not drilling through that. Mm-hmm. And then 2 pieces of wood we've never done anything like that before. And then you have this slow set epoxy, but it'll hold like a couple tons. And so if you're not fast enough, then things are gluing up that are not ready to go together. And it was panic. It was bedlam. Just trying to get these things stuck together in a shape that I think the second knife I made, one of the pins didn't go through. And the closest thing to me was a bamboo skewer, because it was like right by the grill. And so I just grabbed that and like jammed that in there and just snapped it off at the end. I didn't care. It was just going to be like it's just a test knife. But that's always been one of the hardest parts. Just an absolute panic moment. Mm-hmm. Oh, these don't align. What do we do? Fix something,
So we've obviously altered our process to do some dry fitting before we mess with the glue up. So
that's where the learning part comes in. But for the first knife, it was terrifying. That bit was. But then once it was all done and everything, again, we loved them. Loved them. Now we look back at them and they're hideous. But when you first make it, it's like anything. It almost brings you back to being a kid when you think you've made something. You build a tree fort or whatever, and you got some rusty old nails and a couple of boards, and you bang them into a tree, and you're just like, yes, this is amazing. I've never had anything like this before. So the first time you make something like that, it was super exciting. But we knew we had so much to learn. There was so much to learn to make them legitimate and worth selling. But
what do people say when you tell them that you make knives, or what did they say when you said, I'm going to learn how to make knives?
It's an interesting conversation, and truthfully, it depends on who you talk to. My brother-in-law, who is Mr. Outdoorsy, he was like, when do I place my order, because I want a knife. But, other people, it's like, but you don't do that. You work in a cube. So it's just kind of guiding that conversation. It really depends on who you talk to. But we've had a lot of support and a lot of interest. And that's been the neat thing, though, is to be able to continually have conversations. There's a guy at work I'm thinking of who, for the last 2 years, I've been working on him to try to order a knife. And then he finally came to me last week and said, I made some soup for a bunch of people last week. And after about 20 minutes, my hand was hurting. I said, man, I can help you out. He's like, I know. Now that I know that you make knives. So it's becoming less strange to people.
It's a lot of it's about exposure.
That's it.
When most people walk up on us at a market, they have never seen a handmade knife. The vast majority of people. We have some return customers, and they always are excited to see whatever we have. But most people have never seen one, including our families. Our families have been very supportive. I mean, we wouldn't be anywhere near where we are if our families weren't supportive. They were, they love them. Every knife they see, they're like, this is amazing. What you guys do is amazing. This is awesome. Keep going. Some people are, they're a little skeptical or just sort of bewildered. Why would you make a knife? Yeah. Like, I can buy a perfectly good knife in a blister pack in Walmart. I mean, you can't, but, people are surprised by that. Yeah, they think they can. I mean, it's okay. It's serviceable. Don't get me wrong. It's serviceable. But, it's a mix of excitement, surprise. Excitement's the one, obviously, that's a lot of people, when they pick it up and they try it, they're just blown away by how much different it is than their knives. And that's what we go for. that's when it feels really good, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's been really neat to be able to tell that story with people, because especially at the farmers markets, we'll see people walking by our booth and just giving us this look like, what is happening over there?
Right.
And so it's been neat to be able to say, yeah, just come here, let's talk, you know. And so we
just carrot.
Yeah, grab that carrot, take that knife, and then that look of, whoa, I didn't know a knife could do that. Yes, it can. And yes, we did that. So
yes. Yeah. I think that is so cool, and I think that's the beauty of you being at farmers markets. Now, did that idea come to you easily? Did you decide, you know, early on that that's how you would sell them?
Yeah. Well, so honestly, the idea came as a sort of a step stool, because again, I had already been doing sharpening for years. And what we thought is, well, there at the time when you searched for knife sharpening in Indianapolis, you were lucky to find anything. I mean, there were maybe two around somewhere in and around the city that you could find, but nowhere, no one out here was doing it that we were aware of. So we thought, well, I mean, I know how to sharpen a knife, so we could at least offer that. And while we're there, then, you know, we'll start bringing our knives and we'll see, we'll get a feel for what people think about them.
Okay, now I have to ask, this is the, you know, the $20,000 question. How much do your knives cost? What kind of a price point can people expect?
Sure. Well, we can kind of limit this to kitchen knives, mm-hmm. if that's all right. They will typically start at $175 for a paring knife. So 3.5-inch, 4.5-inch blade, probably about 8 inches overall. And they can go up to $450, honestly, depending on, you know, this gyucho we made for this chef, you know, a 9.5-inch blade, super long, super mean, super lean. That's what that's going to run. But we've talked about the petite chef, and that's that 6.5-7-inch knife that's really popular. And right now, those are going for about $300.
We've been talking with Eric Gieseman and Eric Smith of Ash Blades. For more information, go to Ash Blades. That's BLAEDS.com. I'm Jolene Ketzenberger, and we are back here on Eat Drink Indiana Radio with a roundup of some favorite entrepreneurial interviews, conversations with local artisans who learned how to do it themselves and then launched a business to do it. So far today, we've talked bread and bacon and knives, and now we turn to coffee. I talked with Indianapolis residents Andy and Sarah Hessler recently about Blue Mind Roasting and how they launched a coffee roasting business right in their own backyard.
Well, for us, it started with the popcorn popper, as it sometimes does. But first, I just wanted to, we had been in Louisville and really liked the coffee scene there and really knew a lot of people connected to it. And just kind of getting into that third wave coffee movement somewhere, there's a tendency to roast a little bit lighter, to pay more attention to origins, to flavors. Just having more care with the roasting and really enjoyed that. So when we moved here, not that there weren't some good coffee shops and things going on in Indy, but where we were just wasn't quite as accessible as it was. And so bought this popcorn popper and started. There's a place called Sweet Maria's that sells a lot of to a lot of home roasters green coffee, and you can learn a lot about coffee roasting there. And so just started buying green coffee and just roasting for fun with the popcorn popper.
Now, so a popcorn popper, I mean, this is just like a real hot air popcorn right. popper, right?
It was an air popper. I think it was Poppery 2. I bought it off of eBay. I think it's like manufactured in 1980-something. But
right, so they're old school popcorn poppers.
Yes. Mm-hmm. The one I had was, and those tend to be popular. Yeah, and it was old school. And there wasn't a lot of thought for me. I just put it in. There's not a lot of heat control. You just put it in and turn it on and it goes. I had it in a box, kind of trying to control the air or the temperature with whether the box was open, but yeah.
So you just put it in there and turn it on?
Plug it in, and it took, I don't know, maybe 3 to 5 minutes. It would start to turn yellow and turn brown, and then coffee starts to crack. And when it's getting close to being done, there's a first crack and a second crack, and different people, depending on how you roast, stop at a different time. So went through that whole cycle, and yeah.
So how were those first coffee beans roasted? How did it come out early on?
It was okay. It wasn't like what I was getting in Louisville at places like San Argos Coffee or Quills there. But it was a little bit lighter how I was wanting it. So I was getting a little more of the fruit notes that I was kind of hoping for, but it wasn't great by any means. And I've learned a lot about roasting since then that's helped bring out more of the flavors. So
how long did you do that? How long was it, you know, a hobby that you were, you know, fooling with a popcorn popper?
Probably 6 or 9 months, and then decided to buy a home roaster to kind of take it to the next level. And with the thought that maybe we would go into business at some point, but at the time, not really sure. And just kind of wanting to roast better coffee than the popcorn popper.
Now, Sarah, what did you think about this? Were you into the coffee too? Were you roasting and kind of getting into this as it first started out as a hobby?
The funny thing is I did not like coffee at all. Actually, probably the first coffee I ever drank and liked was coffee that Andy had roasted on, I don't know if I drank it from the popcorn popper, that coffee, probably not. It was maybe more when he started home roasting on the hot top is when I would start drinking it. And he would get an Ethiopia natural, which is a really flavorful coffee, blueberry notes, really fell in love with it. That was kind of the first time that I really started drinking coffee, which is kind of funny.
So how did it grow from there, from getting some coffee that people were starting to like? And then is that when you started thinking, well, you know, maybe this could be something?
Yeah, when I was roasting on the hot top, that home roaster, we started giving samples to people and getting good feedback. And I learned a lot about the roasting process and was feeling a little more confident about it. And when people were saying, I liked it, but when other people were saying they liked it too, that's kind of when we were thinking more seriously about doing something with it.
Because we're sitting right now in a coffee roastery, you know, that you have built, you know, behind your home. So did you envision this early on?
I don't think we envisioned the roastery per se, because we didn't know what we were getting into. At first we thought maybe we could just do this in our basement in our house, which is when we realized that coffee's treated like any other food product, we realized that wasn't going to work. So we did know that we were going to have to take things up a notch, but the extent we have, I don't think at the very beginning we were quite sure of. But
when did you know that? When did you decide that this is what you're going to do?
Right. Well, it's when people started liking it, we knew we wanted to, we had kind of decided some other work I had been doing kind of dried up, and it was like kind of the perfect time to try something different. And so we knew we wanted to sell it on some level. So we were confident of that. But the more we pried into it, we realized this was going to be a little more complicated, and we were going to need things like water, sinks, toilets, signs that say employees must wash hands, and all these things. So it just was kind of a slow realization. And then we made the decision to build this space.
Now, when was that? Like what year? How long have you been roasting in here?
The building finished up in December of 2015. So we've only been in here for about 9-10 months.
2016 was the year then, yeah, that this right. became a real coffee roastery.
That's right. Yeah. So the beginning of the year was when it really all started.
Mm-hmm. Now, I have seen it in various stores around Indianapolis, Blue Mind Coffee. So tell me about how the name came about and then how you started getting your coffee out there.
Right. The name comes from a song by a singer-songwriter named Alexi Murdoch. Off an album that was, I think, 2007 or 8. And the song's called Blue Mind. And my take on the song is it's just about losing yourself kind of in your thoughts, slowing down, just kind of pulling back a little bit from the fast pace of the modern world to just reflect. And that was always kind of my experience of really good coffee, was slowing down. You know, it takes some time to grind if you're going to do a pour over. You really notice things that you don't normally notice if you just go to the local Starbucks, or if you're running it through a automatic drip or whatever. And so, and then just taking some time to slow down and drink a nice cup of coffee and notice the flavors and just kind of get lost in your thoughts. And it's something that, it just kind of, the song just kind of went together with my experience of coffee very much, taking some time in the morning to reflect and slow down. And so that's where the name came from. And it kind of speaks to this larger vision we have of that idea of slowing down and kind of taking a step back from the fast-paced world to focus on the things that matter a little bit more.
So how do you go from, having a name to getting it into the stores?
We had a friendship with the folks at Agrarian because we have backyard chickens. And Sarah especially spent a lot of time in there learning about chickens and buying feed. And so they were the first ones to start carrying it. And then Sarah does a lot of the kind of the business side of things and reaching out to people. We both do, but she does it more. And that's kind of partly her side of things.
Where did you see it going?
Yeah, we really wanted it to be at places that Indy considered like their local go-to grocery place, that other local goods were sold there as well. So like, we have it at Wildwood down in Fountain Square and Goose the Market and Pogue's Run and Homespun on Mass Ave. So just different little parts of Indy that are known for having good local goods. So,
and at the Safeway at 56th and Illinois, which is where people pop in for a gallon of milk and coffee, I would imagine.
Definitely, yes. Safeway. It's kind of funny. Not everybody would think that we would have our coffee at Safeway, but it's been great. I love the manager, Jeff. He has been awesome having our coffee there on the shelves, and it sells really well there. And so it's our neighborhood where we live, and so it works out really perfect.
We've been talking with Andy and Sarah Hessler of Blue Mind Roasting. For information on where to find their coffee, go to bluemindroasting.com. I'm Jolene Ketzenberger, and you've been listening to Eat Drink Indiana Radio on WFYI HD2 The Point. Thank you so much for tuning in to our DIY-focused show this week, and thanks also to our guests, Haley McGinley of Native Bread, Mark LaFay of Old Major Market, Eric Gieseman and Eric Smith of Ash Blades, and Andy and Sarah Hessler of Blue Mind Roasting. And thanks also to producer John Ketzenberger for helping to bring you Eat Drink Indiana Radio.